Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Nick Augustine, and I'm here with attorney Anita DiCarlo of the Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants and affiliated with Michael V. Favia and Associates. The Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants is a group of highly experienced attorneys and investigators who represent and defend licensed professionals. Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants is a group of highly experienced attorneys and investigators who previously worked for the IDPR, Illinois Department of Professional Regulation, will represent and or defend licensed professionals in cases involving the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, Illinois Department of Public Aid, and Illinois Department of Public Health. For more information about Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants, you may visit the website www.il-licensing.com. You can also find the group on Facebook at facebook.com/ Illinois Professional Licensing Consultant Attorneys and on Twitter at licensing_attorneys. Today's program is Workers' Compensation and Healthcare Employees with attorney Anita DiCarlo. Some of the topics we'll cover on today's program, I will introduce attorney DiCarlo and talk to her a little bit and then ask her about how workers' compensation law works in Illinois generally. We'll discuss some common injuries that give rise to workers' compensation claims. We'll also talk about the 2011 amendments to the workers' compensation law in Illinois. We'll talk about wage differentials, rebuttable presumptions, carpal tunnel caps, operative versus traumatic injuries, and we'll also discuss some measures that healthcare industry workers can take to reduce the risk of injury. As well, we'll note on how healthcare administrators, managers, and workers' compensation trends are occurring and where we think the industry may be going in the future and what people can do to be best informed. My guest today is Anita DiCarlo, and she is a workers' compensation attorney associated with the Chicago Health Law and Litigation firm of Michael V. Favia and Associates and the Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants. Anita earned her Juris Doctorate from the John Marshall Law School, and she is an active member of the Justinian Society of Lawyers and served as the co-president of the John Marshall Chapter. She was recognized as an Illinois Rising Star by Super Lawyers and received a Distinguished Service Award from the John Marshall Law School. Anita is a frequent speaker and article writer in the area of workers' compensation law in Illinois. Again, for more information about the Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants, visit the website. You may also contact Anita for more information at 773-631-4580 and by email at anita@dicarlolawgroup.com. By way of short disclaimer, this is a general information program, and the advice shared on the show does not constitute legal advice. Communication with our attorney guests among guests and callers on the show cannot give rise to an attorney-client relationships. Again, if you have further questions, you should call the law firm of Michael V. Favia and Associates and ask to speak to Anita DiCarlo by dialing 773-631-4580. All right, let's go ahead and say hello to Anita. Anita, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Nick. How are you?
I am well. I'm looking forward to this conversation about workers' compensation. I always learn new things during these Internet radio podcast. So let's go ahead and talk about your background and how you chose this area and how you got into workers' compensation.
Sure. My dad was a workers' compensation lawyer, so that's how I got into it. He did it for about 50 years, representing both on the defense side and on the injured worker side. And the end of his career was solely based on the employee side. When I began practice, I did a very small amount of defense work, which I think just hones your skills a little bit better, so you know what to look out for and arguments to be made that sometimes you don't see when you haven't seen the other side of the fence. But at this point, I solely represent injured workers and workers' compensation cases.
All right, so you are the plaintiff's attorney, and it is good, I agree, to have worked both sides of the coin. A lot of people have done that, and that's something that's very valuable, I know, to clients because you can best anticipate what you're likely to encounter. So in a lot of people who think about workers' compensation claims, most people think of the guy who is up on the roof hammering nails and slips on the ladder, falls, and breaks an ankle. But today we're talking about healthcare industry workers. So we'll talk about, you know, office work, that, you know, carpal tunnel and different things that can lead to injuries there. Also, I suppose you could get your foot run over by a cart in a hospital. There's so many different aspects, and we'll get into some of those. But before we delve into workers' compensation from a healthcare industry worker perspective, let's just talk a little bit about how workers' compensation law works in Illinois for the benefit of those who have might not yet encountered the system.
Great. Well, I like to say that workers' comp is three types of money, as I describe it to clients. So the first type of money would be all of your medical bills need to be paid by your employer. The second type is when you're off work, you need to be paid, and you don't get paid your full wages, that you only get paid two-thirds, but then there's no tax taken out. And that's, you know, that's supposed to be fair. It doesn't actually work out that way, but when the act was instituted at the turn of the last century, it was one of those compromises that was made at the time. And then the last part is going to be what we call permanency. So that can be a number of things. That can be a death benefit. That can be what we call a wage differential for somebody who finds employment doing something else and isn't making the same kind of money. It can be what we call a PPD award, which is a percentage of loss of use of one of your body parts, or it can be disfigurement. If you simply just have a scar, we really just call it kind of disfigurement. And that's an overly broad explanation. But, you know, let me give you a little bit of the history of the Act, because I think it's important to talk about. Before the turn of the last century, if anybody was injured at work, you were required to file a personal injury lawsuit. And that would require you to prove that your employer did something wrong or was negligent in some way, and that caused you to be injured. And for most of workers' comp injuries, you're not able to do that. So, for instance, if a nurse is lifting a heavy patient and injures their back, there's no way to prove that your employer was in any way associated with that injury, and you would simply lose. And if you think about working conditions at the turn of the last centuries with factories and such, it was a major problem. So workers' comp benefits, you never get the kind of money that people who are in car accidents get, because we are completely regulated by a statute, and what you receive is contemplated to be much smaller, but the thought behind it was that this way more employees would be able to get money, especially when they're off work and unable to work. You'd be getting your weekly benefits as opposed to waiting until you return to work and then getting a cash payout, because people need to pay their mortgage and buy groceries on a weekly basis. So I think that's a pretty good general overview.
All right. So, you know, basically designed to keep people afloat while they, you know, while they heal.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the common injuries. You mentioned a few, but, you know, I suppose people are imagining healthcare industry workers, and lifting a patient might be something that someone who's not worked in a hospital or that setting might have thought about. So there's a potential back injury there. What are some of the different types of injuries and things that you've encountered in your practice?
Sure. You know, slips and falls, because there's some type of a fluid on the floor. Sometimes someone's foot kind of gets planted and there's a twisting injury of the knee. You know, you can always have a break if somebody, you know, simply trips over a cord. Land on an outstretched arm. You can have a rotator cuff tear. I mean, pretty much any injury that can happen to a medical worker, including, you know, even a carpal tunnel syndrome from repetitive, you know, typing. If somebody does a lot of typing, you know, now with electronic records and stuff like that.
What about exposure to hazardous materials or needle pricks or things like that, can those give rise to injuries or concerns or claims?
It absolutely can. Those cases are it's going to depend exactly what happened. So if it is simply a needle, I mean, the standard to proving the causation between the contamination will come up. So obviously the stronger the evidence or, being able to prove that patient, you're going to need to identify, you know, that it was patient John Doe, who was hospitalized on a specific day and that you very specifically pricked yourself on that day in order to try to prove it. I mean, if it's a situation where somebody's in an emergency room and bleeding out and you get some type of a bodily fluid in your eye or in your mouth, it's probably, it's a much more difficult situation to prove, but it is provable.
Mm-hmm. And then real quick before we jump into some of the amendments and changes in the law for the benefit of not only the potential claimants out there, but also for other lawyers practicing in this area, can you just talk about the general procedure if someone has an injury? How, what do they do next? Do they do they run everything through their the administration at the healthcare facility there? Do they go right to a lawyer? What's the procedure look like?
The best thing that you can do is to give notice of your accident as soon as possible. So even if you think, I lifted a patient and my shoulder's a little bit sore, but I know it's going to get better, and if you don't give notice and then a week later it gets really bad and then you have your MRI and then it's diagnosed you have a rotator cuff tear, it's going to be more difficult to prove that you were injured a week before. So definitely giving notice as soon as an accident happens is going to be important to protecting your rights. The next thing would be, if you need to go, get into a doctor as soon as you need to, you are the person who's going to know if you need to go to an emergency room. If you don't need to go to an emergency room, getting into your doctor that day or the next day is certainly good enough. But when you delay treatment for a week or 2 weeks, it certainly looks more as if it wasn't as serious as now it is, and possibly something else had occurred to make it worse. And then talking to an attorney, the insurance company, or the third party administrator works for your employer. So their job is to not spend money and to do whatever's possible to not spend money. And sometimes they're very nice. Sometimes they're very charming, but at the end of the day, it's their job to not spend the money, and you need to talk to somebody who's representing your interests as an injured worker, making sure that you know your rights. The insurance company doesn't have to explain to you what your rights are.
Mm-hmm. They're very important. Yeah. So if you do have an injury at work, and then are out, lifting 50-pound sacks of dog food, into the back of your car. There's all sorts of things that could possibly work against you, even though you're a completely innocent person with a claim. So let's move on to these amendments. These 2011 amendments sound pretty significant.
So what happened was the employer's insurance company, self-insured, believed that the injured workers in Illinois are getting too much money. And so there was a huge movement to change that. And what I think is really interesting and that most people don't know is that most of the fraud in a workers' comp case actually comes from the employer side versus the employee. And people really have that never gets into the media. What gets into the media is, that one guy who's, maybe not hurt and is faking. So that will make news coverage that everybody will hear about. But, the hundreds of employers who are saying, yeah, guess what? That guy never worked for me. He never got hurt that day. That stuff never makes it into the news. So they really tried to minimize recovery in 2011. And some of the things that happened were in Illinois for medical bills, the petitioner, the injured party, should not be responsible for paying a dime of it. But we have what's called a fee schedule. So what the insurance company pays is going to be regulated. So that amount that they were getting paid for per the fee schedule went down. So the doctors are getting less money. The insurance companies are paying less money. That doesn't really have an effect on the injured worker. The next thing is that prior to 2011 changes, the injured worker who was unable to return to work in their prior job would receive what we call a wage differential for the rest of their lives. So this change in that part of the act changed a couple things. First, it codified that the difference is going to be, when it's temporary and then permanent, it's going to change. The difference you get is 2/3 of the difference between the gross amount that the petitioner was earning versus the net amount. And the second thing it did is it capped it at age 67 or for 5 years from the final award. So previously you'd be able to receive that for until the end of your life. You would essentially be getting, you know, think of it as a pension payment every week, every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So you say now it's 2/3 of net? What's the math
again
on that?
No, now it's 2/3 of the gross. 2/3, okay. It's between 2/3 of the gross that you could earn at your prior employment and what you're currently earning today. So, for example, if you...
So your capacity versus your actual.
Right. So if today in your old job you could earn $900 a week and you have found a new job and you're earning $600 a week, you would be receiving 2/3 of the difference. So you'd be getting a check for $200 from the insurance carrier.
2/3 of the $300 difference. Got it. And so that's not for life. So that's at a fixed, time you say, or is that at a period are renewable?
It's capped at age 67 or mm-hmm. 5 years from the final award, whichever is longer. If you lived prior to this, if you lived to be 110, you would get the benefits until you were 110.
And so again, we're not factoring in there the if you have a percentage of permanent disability or disfigurement that you don't.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're just saying that's a separate issue.
Correct. So you're the third type of money that I talk about being the mm-hmm. permanency is divided into different plans. So a death benefit is a specific benefit that you receive. The wage differential would be a specific benefit that you would receive, or the percentage of loss of use. So typically you're not going to get all of them or two of them. Sometimes there's a mix, but this is just specifically for the wage differential.
Understood. Got it. Okay.
So, right, and then one of the other big changes was utilization review, which is supposed to speed up you getting your medical treatment. They have a medical provider look, and then there's a process by which the insurance company can then either say, yes, go get that surgery, or go get that MRI, or no, we don't think you need it. And it's a pretty generic summary. There's a bunch of other things, but probably boring.
So the process is, under the 2011 amendments, that process was streamlined to be more effective and efficient?
That's what it's supposed to do. I don't know if I would agree that it has become more effective and efficient.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other, the rebuttable presumptions that you had mentioned when we had spoken earlier. Can you talk about rebuttable presumptions and what those might be and where those might be changed with the law and the changes in 2011?
Absolutely. The reason why we talked about that was along with the other changes, there's prior to 2011 amendments, if somebody was intoxicated, which is something that very rarely happens, again, that's one of the things that you'll see news stories about, but it's something that very rarely happens. in my 15 years, I've encountered this issue twice. So it's not something that you see every day. Previous to that, if there was any type of intoxication, whether alcohol or drug related, the injured party would still be able to recover as long as you were able to prove that the employment was still a cause of this injury. Now, if you take if you end up at the emergency room, they're going to automatically test you. If it comes up positive, it is a rebuttable presumption that you were impaired and that your work is not related to this accident. So in essence, what it means is, while the injured worker always has the burden of proving every element of your case, the insurance company doesn't have to help money from them. It's your job to prove to them that you're entitled to it. This now says, if there is a finding of intoxication, I, the judge, am going to assume you're intoxicated, it's your problem, it's not your employer's problem, and then you have to work a lot harder to prove how it is your employer's problem and why they should be paying you. So it just makes things a little bit more difficult. And then another thing we talked about previously was carpal tunnel. Carpal tunnel syndrome, I think, since this is directed at healthcare providers, pretty much know what this condition is, but most of the time it's a repetitive trauma type injury, using force and repetitive motions of your wrists. And carpal tunnel cases, there were a lot of them. And so in order to cut down, what they've said is they've limited the amount of money that you can get as far as a percentage of loss of use if it's repetitive trauma. If, however, it is a traumatic carpal tunnel, so if you fall with your arms outstretched, you could end up with a carpal tunnel injury, then it's a little bit less. But carpal tunnel and repetitive traumas are looked at with a little less favorably than a traumatic injury. And also, it's just a lot easier to prove it's work-related. You know, as you said, if somebody falls off a ladder and breaks their leg, it's pretty easy to prove that when they climbed up that ladder, the leg wasn't broken. But with a repetitive trauma, you have to prove that the work caused it or was a cause or an aggravating factor. So It just makes things a little bit more difficult.
So overall, would you say that the 2011 amendments and how this all worked has reduced or increased the burden on healthcare administrators and managers and those who are in a position to work to try to reduce the frequency of injury or try to mitigate loss?
Well, as far as reducing injury, I mean, if you're talking about a carpal tunnel syndrome, I think you need to have the ergonomic studies performed and provide people with an appropriate workplace to try to stop that from happening. As far as stopping workplace injuries, I mean, it's more of an OSHA standard than what we deal with, but I think that healthcare administrators and workers' comp, one of your biggest things to focus on would be the fee schedule and making sure that all of your coding is correct. And I think that's your biggest problem, is dealing with the insurance carriers to determine what the appropriate payments are. And, because there's, and I'm not an expert in this, but there's coding and there's modifiers, and you have to deal with so many different insurance plans. And as far as healthcare goes, you have to deal with Medicare, you have to deal with Medicaid, and now you have this whole new thing entering. I mean, it's not new because that change happened a while back, but it's very difficult. That's one of the problems that we see the most, is an a medical provider's version of what they think the bill should be versus the insurance carriers.
So did extra work involved?
I think it is, and I think that the healthcare providers need to. I don't think you can hire someone out of college or to do their billing anymore. I think you need people who have really specific training in the billing field in order to determine if you're getting the right amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the other things that is a common problem in workers' compensation, generally speaking, is the use and sometimes the unintended but incidental addiction to opioids, especially when, this is something that we're going to talk about in a future program, nurses and nurses having access to different painkillers. What, if anything, have you seen in the industry as far as a rise or exposure or awareness about opioid abuse and use, and do you think it's a significant concern?
Well, I think that if, anybody who's taking an opioid for a medical condition, there obviously is that risk of addiction. And so I think that doctors need to be very careful and monitor it and make sure that they're, you know, making a determination of whether this is a drug-seeking behavior or whether this is truly pain-based. I think that insurance companies are aware of the possibility for addiction and that it's not really this, you know, this injured person's fault if it does indeed occur. It's not a choice that they're making, such as I'm not going to go to physical therapy and then you choose that your condition is going to end up being worse. If you do something to make your condition worse, there would be some type of a ramification. I don't think that opioid use or drug addiction would be seen that way. And I think that most insurance companies, self-insured, et cetera, when they see this becoming a problem, are more willing to offer programs in order to get people off of those pain medications because it works as a double-edged sword. First of all, it's the best thing for the injured party. And secondly, it's going to change the outcome it's going to change the final outcome in that they're not going to be responsible for $1,000 of medication every month for the rest of this person's life. So I think it's better. The reaction to it is much better. I don't know if I answered the whole question.
I think we covered it. It's something that I've seen in a few articles and things that we've covered in a recent blog article as well. Again on Illinois-licensing.com. It's been something that's been discussed by several folks. And not to put you on the spot as a legislative expert by any means, but just wondering what new word on the street there may be about some of the talk about reform to workers' compensation in Illinois. I know that new Governor Bruce Rauner has talked about different ways to there are people appealing to him as well on for workers' compensation reform. I'm just curious if any of the things that we've talked about today are things that are being discussed in the reform arena.
I take issue with people calling that a workers' compensation reform. And the reason is that injured workers in the state of Illinois, it is true, are treated better than injured workers in the state of Indiana, the state of Wisconsin. But I think that's a really good thing. What's very, very interesting, and again, this is something that doesn't make news headlines and people aren't seeing, but what's interesting is that these quote-unquote reforms in 2011, the changes in 2011, caused a dramatic decrease in what insurance companies, self-insureds, and TPAs are paying out. But insurance, the average employer who has an insurance company representing them doesn't see the benefit of that because the insurance companies have not reduced premiums. And there recently was hearings in Springfield about this, and the insurance companies said, well, we don't have the data. We can't give you the data on why there's been no decrease, and in fact, in most cases, there's been increases in premiums since 2011, even though there is documented lower payouts. And so I think it's really important to note that, you know, the only people who are going to see the difference are the people who are self-insured, because they know that on a specific injury, I didn't pay $50,000 in medical bills, I paid $20,000 or, you know, whatever the difference would be. So what's interesting is that employers keep complaining that they're paying more and more money when, in fact, the person who's earning that money is the insurance companies.
Right, right. Well, and I think largely this is a political issue as well, and we're in another election cycle, so you know, things of this nature do get politicized. And I always say, go to someone who practices in the area. Ask someone who does this for a living. Don't ask the politician, ask the practitioner. Anita, any following thoughts on workers' compensation or anything you'd like our audience out there to know about?
No, I think it's just, you know, just definitely if you do get injured, make sure that you report it and you go see a doctor and have somebody who's assisting you, who's looking out for you and not your employer. If somebody comes into the office or the hospital and is injured, if you can make sure you mark that down in the office notes, that's going to really help somebody who's injured. If the nurse or the doctor doesn't say, you know, just simply writes down, Nick was injured on such and such a date, but doesn't write those two words at work, a lot of times that can harm an injured worker. So if they can just take the time to write those two words down, if that's the case, it would be wonderful.
There you go. All right. Well, folks, you can always get a hold of Anita DiCarlo by dialing 773-631-4580 through the law firm of Michael Favia and Associates. You can also send her an email at anita@dicarlolawgroup.com. Anita, I want to thank you for your time today. I've appreciated that and enjoyed this program.
Thanks, Nick, so much. I had a great time.
All right. Well, and I want to thank all of our listeners out there for listening. And also, when you find this program in your social network feeds through LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook, or so on, please do the kind thing and share the program so that other people who might benefit from this knowledge can find this programming. So I want to thank you all for that as well. Anita, thank you again, and have a good day. And we will be back soon on another edition of the Illinois Professional Licensing Consultants Podcast. Thank you all, and have a great day.
Bye.